pull up that stool over there. No, the metal one by the crash cart.
Yeah, the other one squeaks, and any sharp noise sets them off.
Right. Welcome to the night shift. I know it's your first rotation here at the nursing desk, so just keep your voice down, keep your head on a swivel.
And whatever you do, try not to make direct eye contact with the patients wandering the hall.
Exactly. You are currently standing in the high-security psychiatric ward of the commercial real estate industry.
I mean, it is standing room only these days. Just look at them out there, shuffling past the water cooler.
The supposed titans of industry.
Right. The visionaries who built skylines, the master developers, all of them just, you know, wandering around in backless gowns, completely detached from mathematical reality.
Yeah, suffering from acute market disorientation. It's honestly exhausting just monitoring their vitals.
It really is.
So tonight, our primary mission is to review the latest clinical diagnostic notes with you, just so you understand exactly what kind of cognitive decline we're dealing with on this floor.
We're reviewing a Q2 2026 diagnostic report titled Alternative Capital Market Disorientation.
And we should probably establish right now that these particular charts come from the only clinician in the building who hasn't completely lost his mind.
Oh, absolutely. Chief of Surgery Priyanshu Adithakar.
Right.
Priya is, frankly, the only lead investigator conducting actual forensic autopsies on these deals.
While the rest of the industry is sitting in the corner, happily polishing their pro formas with crayons.
Yeah, hallucinating a return to 2019. But Priya is actually cutting open the contracts to see what killed the patient.
So let's look at our first admission. That agitated patient pacing aggressively by the double doors. We classify this demographic as the small-scale CRE investor matrix. They are currently exhibiting severe panic attacks.
Well, because the traditional relationship-driven regional banks they used to rely on have simply vanished.
Flatlined. Gone.
And that massive liquidity vacuum has been filled by private credit.
Right. As Pride notes in the patient's chart, there is a systemic skepticism and a deep-seated apprehension that these alternative credit structures are inherently predatory.
That they'll just completely wipe out their equity.
Exactly. They are quite literally pointing at the shadows and hallucinating that private credit is a monster under the bed.
Which brings us to Pry's overarching treatment plan, which relies heavily on brutal reverse psychology.
Heavily.
Because these patients are trapped in a feedback loop of denial, they need to realize that the magic beans of the old banking world are dead.
The historically cheap debt, the friendly loan officers who took them golfing and waved off minor covenant breaches.
Buried. The era of the friendly neighborhood bank is over. They have to start clinging to inflated, hallucinatory internal rates of return.
And they have to start looking at the actual brain of the deal.
The legal structure, right.
Right.
If they don't understand the anatomy of this new capital, they will bleed out on the operating table.
Yeah, and they won't even realize their equity's gone until the lender changes the locks on the building.
It's grim.
So I want to deconstruct this primary hallucination for you, because you're going to hear it constantly during your shifts.
Oh, every single night.
It's this tragic, lingering belief that the regional banks are just taking a little nap.
Like, oh, the banks are just cleaning up their balance sheets for a quarter or two.
Right. It is a massive, industry-wide institutional amnesia.
It's a total rejection of clinical reality, honestly. The banks aren't coming back because they legally can't.
Yeah, this isn't a temporary flu where you prescribe some bed rest and wait for the fever to break.
Exactly. It is a permanent regulatory cage. Traditional banks are being suffocated by strict capital requirements.
Specifically, the final implementation timelines of Basel III and Basel IV, right?
Yeah, the math is just merciless. Regulators are mandating that depository institutions hold significantly more capital against risk-weighted assets.
And commercial real estate, especially transitional or value-add real estate, is designated as a highly punitive risk asset.
So the shrinking of the traditional banking footprint isn't some cyclical phase. It is a mathematical regulatory certainty.
Yet the patients refuse to accept the diagnosis.
Well, of course they do.
So when private credit steps in to keep the commercial real estate market breathing, providing the capital, these developers desperately need to survive.
The patients look at it like some terrifying experimental organ transplant.
Right. They reject it entirely because they don't understand how the anatomy of the new organ functions.
Let's dissect the mechanics of this so-called transplant. Traditional banks run on a very fragile biology.
Volatile deposits.
Exactly. Checking accounts, savings accounts, demand deposits, meaning at any given moment, the depositors can get spooked by a headline, open an app on their phone, and demand all their money back in 30 seconds.
That's the classic bank run.
But private credit funds operate on a completely different biological system. They do not rely on flighty retail deposits.
They are powered by long-term, locked-up institutional equity.
We are talking about pension funds, university endowments, business development companies, interval funds.
It's capital that is structurally insulated from a run. The money is locked in the vault for a designated term.
Right. But then the patients point to the Q2 2026 market indicators, and they start screaming again.
Preece's boots-on-the-ground diagnosis of this delusion perfectly isolates the panic around retail megafunds.
You know the ones, like Blackstone's BCRE hitting its redemption gates.
The patients see a massive fund halting investor withdrawals, and they immediately scream, systemic organ failure. The contagion is spreading.
But that is where the clinical diagnosis separates from the emotional panic of the herd.
Right.
A fund like BCRED hitting its redemption limit is not a symptom of the underlying commercial loans collapsing. It is a feature of the fund's architecture, not a bug.
It is simply the normalization of retail liquidity management.
Exactly. When too many individual investors get nervous and ask for their money back at the exact same time, the fund legally drops the gate.
They pause withdrawals to protect the portfolio from being forced into a fire sale of assets at a steep discount.
But for the borrowers out there in the real world, for the sponsors actually needing the loans to finish their construction projects, these funds remain highly active. They are still writing checks.
Well, they have to. Their biological imperative is to deploy dry powder.
Right. If a debt fund sits on billions in cash and doesn't lend it out, the fund managers don't earn their yield and the fund effectively starves to death.
So we establish for the patient the new organ works. But let's look at the price of keeping them alive.
Right, because putting a sponsor on private credit life support is staggeringly expensive.
Yeah, looking at the lab result, comparing the phantom traditional banks to the reality of private debt funds is a masterclass in pain tolerance.
It really is.
I mean, the old traditional banks were pricing debt at SOFR plus maybe 200 to 350 basis points.
Private credit is a completely different threshold of pain.
Yeah.
You are looking at SOFR plus 275 to 500 basis points.
Mm-hmm.
And that's entirely floating rate debt, meaning the cost of capital breathes heavily on the borrower's neck every time the central bank even hints at inflation.
And it's not just the interest rate bleeding them dry. I'm looking at the origination fees here.
Oh, the fees are brutal.
Banks used to ask for a cute fraction of a percent, maybe a quarter to half a point, just to process the paperwork. These private funds are demanding 1 to 2% up front.
You are bleeding out a massive chunk of your equity just for the privilege of opening the door to the clinic.
Then there's the leverage. Banks capped out, conservatively, at 60 to 65% loan to value.
They kept a safe distance from the edge of the cliff.
But private credit will push you right to the brink.
They will routinely go 70 to 80% loan to value or offer up to 85% loan to cost on transitional assets.
They will gladly hand the patient enough rope to hang themselves if the sponsor's underwriting is even slightly optimistic.
The one actual advantage here is the speed of execution.
True. A traditional bank's credit committee is an agonizing 60 to 90 day crawl where the loan officer has to beg 5 different risk managers for approval.
Private credit is a direct unilateral execution. 2 to 4 weeks, the term sheet is signed, and the money is wired.
But that speed comes with a brutal structural shift. We're moving from a cozy 25 to 30 year amortization schedule to standard interest-only durations of maybe 2 to 3 years.
And the real danger zone, the one that causes the most night terrors on this ward, is the shift in recourse.
Oh, yeah. The sponsors think they are safe because the term sheet says non-recourse.
They assume the lender can only take the physical property if the deal goes sideways. They don't bother to read the fine print on the bad boy carve-outs.
They assume a bad boy carve-out means outright intentional fraud, embezzlement, arson, deliberately driving the property into the ground.
But aggressive private funds expand that definition to weaponize it.
You miss a property tax payment by 48 hours because of a clerical error.
Or maybe you transfer a minority share of the LLC to a family trust for estate planning without asking the lender's permission first.
Suddenly, the non-recourse veil is legally pierced. The lender isn't just taking the commercial building anymore.
They are coming after your personal checking account. They are taking your house.
Private credit exists purely to absorb the transitional value-add risks that traditional banks are now too terrified to touch, and they charge you for every ounce of that risk.
It is highly expensive short-term life support. And life support charges by the hour.
But as Preece points out, the real mortality risk isn't just the sheer cost of the capital. It's the triage process.
Or rather, the complete lack of a triage process by the sponsors.
Ah, yes. the monolithic mistake. If you take anything away from this shift, let it be this: institutional amnesia is fatal here.
The patients wander these halls treating all alternative lenders as if they are one giant, identical blob.
They think a debt fund is a debt fund is a debt fund.
While they are busy making the fonts look pretty on their investor pitch decks, Pri is pulling back the sheet on the morgue table to show them what happens when you don't vet your lender.
You have entirely unregulated loan brokers out there masquerading as direct institutional funds.
And Pri developed a very specific, ruthless protocol for vetting these lenders before you ever let them touch your asset.
Step one is verifying capital discretion.
The litmus test here is highly confrontational, but absolutely necessary. You have to look the lender in the eye and ask point blank, are you a discretionary fund manager with committed capital, or are you just table funding and syndicating this loan deal by deal behind the scenes?
The table funders, they are the absolute worst parasites in this ecosystem.
Oh, completely.
They're like surgeons who don't actually have an operating room or any surgical tool.
Yeah, they put on the scrubs, they pretend they have the money, they tie you up with a legally binding letter of intent, and then they run around frantically shopping your deal to actual legitimate lenders.
And if the macro market shifts even slightly while they're shopping,
they drop you. They walk away.
You bleed out in the waiting room because your maturity date hit and you have no capital. You have to demand lenders who control their own balance sheets.
Which naturally flows into step two of Pri's protocol, assessing the lender's vintage and track record.
Right. You have to investigate how they behaved during the severe 2022 to 2024 rate hike cycles.
When the market seized up and properties couldn't refinance, did this lender act like a rational counterparty? Did they execute pragmatic workouts and extensions?
Or are they organ harvesters? The notorious loan-to-own predators.
Yeah. These are the specific funds that intentionally underwrite loans with suffocatingly tight technical covenants.
They don't actually care about collecting the interest yield.
Not at all. They're just sitting there quietly hoping the sponsor slips into a temporary coma so they can declare a default, foreclose, and seize the asset at a massive discount to replacement cost.
They want the building, and the loan is just the weapon they use to take it.
Moving to step three, evaluating concentration and redemption risk. You have to audit the internal vehicle structure of the lender itself.
Are they a closed-end fund with capital that is legally locked up for 10 years? Or are they an open-end fund currently facing severe redemption pressures from their own investors?
Because if an open-end debt fund is suddenly facing a tsunami of withdrawal requests from its limited partners, the psychology of that lender shifts overnight.
Their asset managers stop being lenders entirely.
Right. They transform into hyper-aggressive collections agents.
They become completely inflexible on even the most minor technical defaults because they are desperate for internal liquidity to pay off their own investors.
This is exactly how Pri saw the symptoms before the family portfolio was traded away. Wait, sorry, it's just an absolute slaughter of equity, purely because the sponsor failed to vet the fund's internal liquidity structure before signing the term sheet.
It is a profound, dark irony of this industry.
It really is.
These real estate syndicators will spend 6 months obsessing over the liquidity and net worth of their own minor equity investors, but they rarely spend 10 minutes investigating the financial stability and liquidity of the entity lending them $50 million.
Yeah, it makes no clinical sense.
So let's transition to the actual surgical intervention. Because as Pri just notes over and over in his reports, in the world of alternative credit, the sponsor's equity almost never dies from the headline interest rate.
No, the rate is just a symptom. It's a slow bleed.
Equity usually dies from the structural landmines hidden deep in the 50-page loan documents.
There are four tactical surgical levers a sponsor has to pull at the negotiating table to protect their lifeblood. Let's look at the first lever: performance-based extensions.
Private debt is inherently short-term capital. You get 2, maybe 3 years.
If your property isn't fully leased and stabilized by that maturity date, or if the macroeconomic environment looks like a post-apocalyptic wasteland and the refinance markets are frozen, you are trapped.
Naturally, the sponsor's instinct is to ask for an extension option in the initial term sheet.
But if you ever see a sponsor sign a loan with at lender's sole discretion extensions during your shift here, you need to pull the fire alarm.
Because what they've actually signed is a death warrant.
Exactly. The lender can simply wake up on the wrong side of the bed, say no, and take the asset. You must aggressively negotiate up to 2 12-month extension options at inception, and you must tie those extensions to objective, undeniable mathematical metrics.
You tie it to a realistic debt service coverage ratio, or a specific debt yield, proving that your net operating income can actually support the loan amount.
You ensure those mathematical thresholds are based on your conservative, stress-tested underwriting, not the lender's perfection-based blue sky model.
And if you hit the required math, the extension becomes automatic. The lender has absolutely no subjective say in the matter.
The second lever is capping the interest reserves. This is where the pathology of private credit gets truly dangerous.
Transitional assets like buildings undergoing heavy renovations usually don't generate enough cash flow on day one to cover these massive floating rate private credit coupons.
So the lender requires an interest reserve account.
Think of the interest reserve as an IV drip of the sponsor's own cash, designed to keep the loan current while the building is empty.
But the lenders don't want to just hook up the IV. They want to empty the entire bag all at once.
They demand that the reserve be fully funded upfront in cash on the day of closing.
It is mathematically parasitic. They hook you up to an IV drip of your own money. They charge you interest on the entire bag while it just sits on the pole.
They are artificially jacking up your average outstanding balance, forcing you to pay interest on capital you haven't even deployed yet.
The structural guardrail against this is demanding the reserve be structured as a future funded facility.
You only draw it down incrementally, month by month, as the interest payments actually come due.
Furthermore, if your leasing team overperforms and your asset stabilizes ahead of schedule, generating positive organic cash flow, that excess cash must be allowed to replenish the reserve account.
And most crucially, any unused reserve capital remaining at the time you pay off the loan must return 100% to the sponsor's equity pocket. You do not cede it to the lender as a backdoor fee.
Lever 3 focuses on covenant cushions. Private credit agreements are notoriously littered with maintenance covenants.
They might demand your debt service coverage ratio remains above a strict 1.15x at all times, evaluated quarterly.
If a tenant moves out unexpectedly and you dip to 1.14x sudden cardiac arrest,
it triggers a technical default. The lender can instantly accelerate the loan, calling the entire balance due immediately.
Or worse, they slap you with a default interest rate, an additional penalty of 5% or more stacked on top of your already painful floating rate note. The asset goes into a death spiral.
So how does a patient survive that kind of sudden cardiac arrest?
Through a contractually explicit covenant cure, right? You have to negotiate this exact mechanism into the documents before you ever sign.
If you breach a financial covenant due to a temporary operational hiccup, you must have the explicit, undeniable right to cure the default yourself.
You do this by either buying down a portion of the principal loan balance out of your own pocket to fix the leverage ratio, or by depositing fresh cash into a shortfall escrow account.
By injecting that sudden liquidity, you mathematically cure the covenant breach and you legally strip the lender of their ability to seize immediate control of the asset.
You buy yourself the time you need to breathe and fix the property.
Finally, lever 4 prepayment penalties.
This is where alternative lenders try to charge you for the privilege of getting healthy too fast. They disguise it as minimum interest clauses.
Private lenders price their loans to guarantee a specific minimum yield for their own institutional investors.
So they routinely insert a 12 to 18 month minimum interest clause into the loan documents.
Meaning, if you are a phenomenal operator, you execute your business plan flawlessly, lease up the entire building in record time, and you are ready to sell the asset or refinance into cheaper permanent debt in month 9.
The lender still charges you for an 18-month stay in their clinic.
It's phantom interest. You're paying heavily for time and capital you aren't even using.
The structural defense here is to ruthlessly negotiate that minimum interest window down to 6 to 12 months maximum.
And you must establish a step-down structure for the penalty itself.
For example, a 1% exit penalty if you manage to pay off the loan in year 1, dropping to completely open and at par, meaning zero penalty, anytime after that.
You must preserve your ability to escape the ward.
If broader market rates suddenly drop or an incredible unsolicited exit opportunity emerges, you need to be able to extract your equity and run without paying a massive punitive toll to the lender at the exit gate.
It is a brutal, unforgiving landscape.
Yeah, it really is.
But when you step back from the individual charts and review the clinical conclusion of Price Report, it all makes a twisted kind of sense.
The constant apprehension, the panic attacks we see in these patients pacing the halls, it is just a psychological reaction.
They are mourning the loss of a low-cost, relationship-driven banking world that no longer exists.
They are terrified of this new, yield-driven, entirely transactional environment where a spreadsheet error can cost them their entire net worth.
But Pry's final prescription to the industry is incredibly clear. It is what he calls the ethical cowboy framework.
You have to treat the alternative private credit lender as a highly sophisticated, potentially dangerous counterparty.
They are not your financial partner. They are certainly not your friend.
But if you vet the fund ruthlessly, and if you prioritize negotiating structural defensive loan terms over begging for minor irrelevant spread reductions on the interest rate, you can safely scale your portfolio without risking total equity annihilation.
So as you begin your shifts here at the nursing station, I want you to remember that.
When you look at the deals these wandering sponsors are bringing in, look right past the polite spreadsheets.
Look past the shiny, artificially inflated pro formas. Always look at the brain of the deal.
Look at the legal covenants, the structure of the interest reserves, the specific math behind the extensions.
That is where the actual life and death of the commercial asset is decided.
And as you settle in for the night, I'll leave you with a rather dark, lingering thought to mull over while you update the charts.
Oh, this should be good.
If Pry's protocol works, if it successfully inoculates the smart money in the room, if the educated sponsors actually learn how to defend their equity against predatory loan-to-own lenders and unregulated table funding brokers,
right,
where do those parasitic entities go next to feed? What unsuspecting asset class or market sector is currently leaving its doors completely unlocked for them?
Well, keep your eyes on the monitors. It's going to be a long night.